Once more unto the breach, dear friends. Else close the wall up with our English dead. Thanks for your patience. This is the first time the studio has been used this morning. They've been using an external studio, and there were switches in all kinds of places that they're not usually. One of them was hiding in the back and had to be moved into a different place. Okay, on the phone line, this is the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jake McClure, and on the phone, hopefully, we've got phones technically working this week. It should be Elder Baldy Jeff McClure. Is this you on the line?
This is old Baldy in the flesh.
All right. Hey, our phone lines sound a little bit more high quality than they did before they went down. Do you think that's coincidence?
I think, well, it could be a virus got into the system.
It could be. It could be. Do you want to do the disclosures?
Let's see. First thing we have to say is the Personal Wealth Coach is not only a name of a radio program, the one you're listening to, and if you're not listening to it, then ignore everything I'm saying.
Yes, if you can't listen to this right now, then we don't want to hear any back talk about what we're about to say.
Right, that's it. It is also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm. When we say SEC-registered, that means we're registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, but it doesn't mean they approve or disapprove of anything. Matter of fact, they disapprove of lots of stuff and very rarely approve of anything, but that's their job. Let's see, what else do we need to say? We need to say that it...
Advertisements?
The two guys are on here are the principals at the Personal Wealth Coach and Investment Advisory Firm, but this is not investment advice that we're giving. This is educational information, which is a different animal altogether, and you'd have to look it up in the zoo to find out which is which, but the reality is...
So illogically, the reality is different.
You're not... It's suggested that we're not giving investment advice, which means it's not something you should act on. It's just information you should use to process. We advertise on this radio program, on the radio, not on the program, but on the radio station, but we don't pay for the radio show. And our advertisements on the radio station are for the radio program, which you can figure out that one way or the other. I haven't quite got my mind around that, but that's the way it works. The information we present on this radio program has been obtained from sources we deem, this is my one time a year, one time a week I can use the term, we deem to be reliable. However, we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said information. Boy, don't you love that.
Was it said information or heard information?
Well, we have to say it for them to heard it.
Right. Okay.
A corralled information. Let's see. Is there anything else we need to tell?
There's so many things that should be given as warnings to people in general. Wear your seatbelt while driving. Wash your hands.
Wash your hands for at least 20 seconds after you've been out and about in public.
Yes, and a good way to do this is if you wash your hands while you're brushing your teeth, so you can save time. Wait. That may be
something that
looks better on paper than in practice.
If you handled your toothbrush prior to washing your hands, then you'd have to wash your toothbrush.
We just need like an inside-outside shower bath thing all the time like they had in the Jetsons. Just
wow,
get
sounds good to me.
Lifted out of the bed, put through some kind of a spray dryer thing that cleaned you up and you didn't even have to do anything, still half asleep. And yes, that's our disclosure for the day.
Well, here we are doing this May 2nd radio program. I'm old Baldy and I'm operating from home because I'm an old Baldy, and the young Baldy is operating from the radio station because he's a young Baldy, but we're all hoping we don't, any of us, get the coronavirus, but a lot of people are. As a matter of fact, well in excess of 1,000 people a day, and this is not a real pleasant thought, are dying from coronavirus in the United States. It's kind of leveled off, but it hasn't really started to decline. So we need to talk about what the markets are doing and what's going on in the rest of the world and what's going on in general. So you want to do that? You want me to do that?
Well, we can jump right in. I can. Was just organizing the document to do it with, so I can do that. At the end of April, so we ended April this week, in case people didn't notice that,
April's behind us. Some people are saying good riddance. Others are saying, is May going to be another April? So it ended on Thursday. For the month, the S&P 500, our age-old friendly index, we use it because it's well-known and it has pretty good chunk of the larger companies in it. No index is truly the best, but this is the one we've been using for a long time. So when we're measuring the market, this is the one we go to. April was the best month in stocks since 1987.
I remember that.
But in 1987, it didn't happen in an April. So we could go back and say it's an all-time best for April.
Wow, now that you talk about it, that is true. It's an all-time best for April.
You can make anything into a record. Like, that was the first time today on the radio that I have said you can make anything into a record. And that's a record, folks. But
for the day.
But when you have a record like this, April's best returns for forever, that says something about what the market did. And 1987, you remember that.
It was up like 12.7% in a month this year.
Which yeah.
A lot more than a lot of people thought it was going to do.
Now, Friday, it did drop back about 2.8%. And that made the week that we've just finished, the business week, the market week that we've just finished, for the S&P 500, the market moved 0.2%, which takes all of the record-breaking stuff and kind of deflates it. Well, that's not much of a movement at all. It's not up, it's not down. It seems like a normal, boring month or a normal, boring week. Closed at 2830.71. Friday's close puts the index down from year-to-date about 12.4% and down about 16.4% from the top in February. So we had a pretty good rise between the beginning of the year and mid-February. We had about a 4% jump upward, more than that. Pretty good jump upward. And then we dropped 16% from the top to where we are today.
But we're up 26.5% from the low in late March.
Right. So when you look back into March, 26.5% drop is our rise is massive. So we were down, what was it we were down at the most? We're right around 37%, 38%?
Well, intraday it was 37%. I think if you used close, it was like 33%, 34%.
Okay.
34%.
So depending on where you're measuring from, we had a 37% drop or a 33% drop. Or just be aware, educationally speaking, that when you're hearing statistics and records from the media about the market, they're trying to sell the press. You can make a record out of everything. The reality is that this is a really rational appearing market, which is a little bit weird. We were talking about that on the phone on the way into the studio. I was on the way into the studio. Your voice was on the way into the studio.
I was digitally traveling with you.
Right. That the market appears to be acting very rationally, and we were tossing back concepts on that. And I mentioned looking at 1960 for the Hong Kong flu, and I mentioned talking about 1918 for the Spanish flu, and comparing market movements, and Dow Jones Industrial Average and Transportation Average were both around in 1918. So we can actually look and see some market data from back then. And those two events are very similar to what we're seeing in the market today, because, and I kind of threw this out, it's a hypothesis, don't take this as a fact, but I think people aren't doing a lot of fear and panic selling because they're so scared that they're not doing anything in the market. They're just saying, just leave it alone, I don't want to think about that and COVID-19 at the same time. And I believe that there's probably good research to be done here that we could take this hypothesis and see if it's accurate. But anecdotally, it appears to be. I've heard a lot of people musing about what should I do, but not, and Morningstar's come out and said 5.4%, only 5.4% of the American public changed their 401k allocation from January through the end of March. So that big movement in the market, it wasn't made by 5.4% of 401k owners moving stuff around. This was bigger hedge funds covering debts and so on. Most people were just too afraid to do anything. That's my thought. What are your thoughts on that?
It's really fascinating to me, and I don't know why people haven't done it, but to give you an example, the market is down roughly 12%. Let's just say it's down 12.
It's a good number to look at. We're talking year to date, so that makes sense. It's not that long ago. It's 4 months ago. We're down 12%.
The market dropped more at the end of 2018 on no particular bad news than it dropped with an avalanche of bad news. It dropped a lot more in 2015 on the price of oil falling. Now, the price of oil fell in 2015. It did.
It doesn't look like a fall compared to what's happening today.
But this is a catastrophic collapse compared with a dip in the price of oil in 2015. And the market went down 20% and just stayed there, nearly 20% and just stayed there in 2015. Until it looked like the oil system was recovering and everything was going to be back to normal, and then it started coming back. And here we have oil actually hitting negative numbers last week, and some oil contracts are still hitting negative numbers.
Let me hit this real quick, if you don't mind. Not hit the negative numbers, but tell people how that works. It's just like milk. If you have too much of it, you got to put it somewhere. You got to get rid of it. And if you run out of storage space locally or in larger areas for oil, you've got to pay to ship it. Even if you don't sell it, it costs you money to move it. A lot of people, it would cost them so much money because they don't know where they would take it to. And this is something we mentioned in the newsletter 2 weeks ago, and I haven't checked it lately. It'd be worth checking into. The super tanker oil transport ships, their lease value is 7 times its normal rate, which means that I was thinking it might be higher at this point.
The really high rates right now are not for the dirty tankers, the ones that crude oil.
Yeah, it's refining.
Super high rates are for the clean tankers, the ones that haul distillates around, because they're still producing at the refineries. Because all the oil is coming into the refineries, and they're trying to keep the refineries running to process the oil so that we don't run out of storage space for the oil, because sometimes the same company owns the oil that owns the refinery.
Right.
And they're producing these distillates that are more expensive, and they don't have any place to put them because we're not using them. We're not driving around.
Right.
And the airplanes are not flying, so they're bringing tankers out of storage. They're bringing tankers. They're finding any tanker they can that can put anything fluid in it.
And you mentioned a couple of things. Airplanes aren't flying, people aren't driving, and I think a really big one to mention is that we're just not using a whole lot of kerosene these days. Sorry, that was tongue-in-cheek.
Well, now, wait a minute. Jet fuel is a form of kerosene, so you're accurate. It's an accurate statement.
It is. Yeah.
The first jet fuel was kerosene, by the way.
Right. Yes, it was, and this is more trivia on natural resources and oil and so on, but the reason why Henry Ford used gasoline for his internal combustion engine, because there's other fuels that are more efficient than gasoline, he used it because it was an excess byproduct of the distillation of kerosene. So people were paying him to take it off their hands, and it's, interestingly enough, it's happening again. People say gasoline has never been in negative territory before. It has. We're not in negative territory in gasoline yet, but it has been in negative territory. It was just before it was used for internal combustion engines.
Let's talk about the Treasury bond, just the Treasury market, just a moment.
Okay, go ahead. You take it.
The Treasury market is the benchmark for all bonds. Now, we're having having unusually large spreads, meaning that the junk bonds, the low-quality bonds, are yielding a very high percentage because, very frankly, the companies that have issued the junk bonds that are called high-yield bonds, used to be called garbage, the reason that they're yielding so highly is that the companies that issued them may not be around in a year or two to pay off the bond. So the default rate has gone up. Nobody really knows how high, but the default rate is going to go up dramatically. And the problem is that if you see someplace that has an unusually high yield, in other words, somebody's promising you 8% or 7% or 6% or even 4% at this point, by definition, you're in high-risk bonds that could default. And that's something to be very much aware of. But the important thing is that you know that the benchmark exists. And the benchmark for complete safety, is the U.S. Treasury bond. The 10-year note, which is the benchmark for the rest of the system,
right,
dropped a tiny 2.7 basis points, but it was zigzagging up and down all week. It's yielding 0.6%.
That's 0.6.
I mean, if you held Treasury bonds for a year, which Treasury 10-year note, if you held it for a year, you'd get 0.6% yield off of it. But the good news about that is the 90-day T-bill is yielding 0.107.
Which by itself doesn't sound like good news, but it means the yield curve's not inverted.
The yield curve is positive and it's smooth and it looks very normal for the fact that the economy is going to recover in some form or fashion in a year to 18 months. Until you take a look at the far end of it, the 30-year bond.
Right.
Now, typically, a 90-day T-bill prior to this event that we're going through right now was yielding 1.something%. They were 1.4, 1.6%. So that was on an annualized basis. So that was a pretty good deal. I mean, it was better than a lot of places. The 30-year Treasury bond, in other words, you buy a bond from the Treasury, you're going to hold it for 30 years before you get your money back, unless you sell it. And they will be glad to pay you 1.25% a year because you loaned them the money.
And I'm going to throw a strategy out there for the U.S. government.
Borrow lots of money at the 30-year point.
Yeah, we're about to borrow a lot of money. Don't be silly and borrow it short-term. Get it in the long-term at 1.25% so that we can pay back some of the debt by the time we get to the point where we got to pay off the rest of the debt.
Well, the good news is there's a very high probability based on what we were seeing before the coronavirus hit, presuming that we're going to come out of the coronavirus event at some point.
I think that is a safe presumption. At some point, we will be beyond this.
Well, I'm trying to be very compliant here. Jake, by the way, is the chief compliance officer of our firm, so I have to be very compliant when I say that.
I think it's a good presumption.
We can't forecast the future, but if we do forecast that we're going to come out of this thing eventually, inflation will probably run something around 2% or a little less. That's a guess. Now, the bond market doesn't seem to think so. The bond market seems to think that 1.25 is a good number. But the reality is, in light of the fact that they have a choice between getting a 1.25% positive return on a U.S. 30-year bond and a negative return by buying bonds in Europe, the world is basically buying U.S. By the way, this is the reason the interest rates are so low is very simple.
Yeah, there's a lot of money available to be loaned.
A lot of people are trying to loan money to the United States government, and they're willing to accept amazingly low interest rates. A lot of governments are trying to loan money to our government. Why? Because for all our warts and pimples, the United States Treasury security, including those green things that you may or may not have in your wallet, those are Treasury securities too, by the way, or Federal Reserve note.
Federal Reserve note, yeah, they're not a Treasury
security. But they're signed by the Secretary of the Treasury.
Correct.
Which means the full faith and credit of the United States government backs that little note, that little short-term note, floating note, bearer note that you carry around that you call money. That is considered to be the most secure place to put your money on the planet. And that is something that...
What, your pocket?
Of all the negative... No,
your pocket is the most. I'm not sure.
Loan it to the United States government.
Oh yeah, okay. Because you said that the green thing's in your pocket. I'm just thinking that's the most. I've got holes in my pocket sometimes. Anyway, go ahead. More tongue in cheek.
Just because your pockets are holier than mine, you don't have to be holier than that.
I mean, thou shalt put your money in my holy pocket.
The reality is, with all the negatives that we're hearing about the way that people are complaining about the way the government's being run, and they're complaining about this, and they're complaining about that, and they're complaining about the Federal Reserve, and they're complaining about the Treasury. And you hear negative news sells papers, and it also sells clicks,
yeah,
which is what is important today. And the reality is we are blessed to live in the most financially secure country on the planet. And I don't mean that with any, there's no hesitation to that.
No.
Others might challenge me and say, well, maybe Singapore is more secure. No, Singapore is not more secure. They don't have much in the way of armed forces. They exist at the tolerance of China.
They are a city-state on the border of a massive empire that they call a chairmanship. What is it? I'm not even sure what they call their form of government anymore. It's a mildly socialistic feudal chairmanship.
Well, it's basically a monarchy.
Yes. It's a feudal chairmanship.
Father to son. Yes. Yeah. But the issue is we're living in a country that has some faults, and it has a lot of things that probably could be adjusted and made better, and that's what we're pretty good at over time. But we're really, really lucky to be living here and really blessed to be living here, and we should be very thankful for it. And I think a lot of people are getting that at this point. Do we have all the solutions? No. Have we got the best solution to everything? No. But we're learning from it, and we're being very self-critical at this point. There's no doubt about the fact that, for instance, Korea had a much better reaction to the coronavirus because they considered it a real threat and they were ready for it. We weren't. We consciously chose not to be ready for it, as a matter of fact. We decided to cut from the budget. And I say Congress does the ultimate budget cutting. The president proposed it. So, and you can't blame one president or the other across the board. Obama and Trump both tried to cut preparedness for a pandemic because we had so many false alarms.
Right. You know, this is the thing that we've said it repeatedly. It's the thing you're not afraid of that gets you. And that's true in the market, it's true in the economy, and it's true with pandemics.
One of the things we have to recognize, now by the way, I wanted to mention this early on when we're talking about the economy. Sweden has placed no restrictions on their people or businesses. Business can open however they want to. People can be as open as they want to. They have recommended social distancing. And they have initially a very low coronavirus rate, although it's picking up rather quickly now. But no quicker than anyone else. Interestingly enough, they are forecasting their GDP to fall by 4% for 2020. So are the main forecasters in the United States forecasting a total for the year of a 4% drop in GDP, 4 to 5% in the United States.
So do you mind if I step in and just kind of restate that?
Sure.
Sweden didn't shut down its businesses, and it's having the same drop in GDP that essentially countries in Europe around it are having when they mandated the companies stop doing business. Because people just didn't show up for work, and they didn't show up to restaurants because it wasn't safe.
That's pretty close. Actually, Europe is having a bigger drop. They're looking at a much bigger drop in their GDP because Italy, and very frankly, this is because Italy lost control of the infection. And Spain lost control of the infection, and Great Britain has lost control of the infection. And as a result, their infection rates are much higher than ours. As of 1 May, United Kingdom, for example, Italy has a 13.6% death rate for confirmed coronavirus cases, and the United Kingdom has 15.6%.
Yeah.
In the United States, we have currently, as of this morning, a 5.8% death rate. We've had 65,888 deaths, and 1,134,000
is that through
confirmed cases.
Is that through Johns Hopkins that you're getting that?
Yeah, Johns Hopkins as of this 8:30 this morning.
Yeah,
and we've had, and if you think, and there's a tendency in Bell County or in Coryell County or in this part of the country to think this is not as big a thing, we're overreacting to it. The confirmed cases rate since in the last 2 weeks has grown 67%. We've gone from 677,000 confirmed cases in the United States to 1,134,000 in 2 weeks. The death rate has risen by 89%, not because we're doing a really bad job, but because it takes a while after people get the disease before they die of the disease. This is a serious thing. The fact that we haven't had an overwhelming pandemic effect in Bell County is because we started social distancing and we started shutting down businesses before the disease got here in force.
Yeah, and do you mind if I step in for just a second and kind of give a comparison? There's something that's happening that I need to point out based on exactly what you're saying. There is a big divide between Democrats and Republicans right now over a political reopening of the economy. And you can get into that and say, why is this even a political issue? Why should it be right wing, left wing? This is just health stuff. Let me give you the demographic reason for that. City populations throughout history are much more affected by pandemics. This seems pretty common sense at this level. You got to build each of the common sense pieces to the puzzle. So large cities, the denser the population, the more likely they are to have a bad event in a pandemic. Rural populations are by definition more diffuse. They're not living on top of each other, literally. I mean, when you're stacking houses on top of each other to make skyscrapers,
and you're riding a subway every day.
You're right. And you're amongst people touching you in the crowds as you walk all day long. Versus Killeen, Temple, this area, it's big, but most people have a car, so we're not walking like in New York, or even in San Antonio or Austin. What we are doing is being more conservative, because this is another thing about dense populations. The denser the population, the more liberal they tend to be. And this is just for a real quick comparison to make it less religious and more about the facts of demographics. If you call the police in Austin at 3 a.m. on a Friday night, you're going to get the police there within 5 minutes. Now, a lot of people will say that's a really long time to get, but if you call the police in Salado at 3 a.m. on a Friday night, you're going to not get someone there unless there's gunshots in the background. And so rural populations tend to have much more concern over gun rights, where the denser populations, they've grown up in an area where the only people that have guns are the bad guys, except the police, who show up relatively quickly when you call them. And the more affluent you are, the better the neighborhood you live in, the more likely you are to be liberal right now, which means why would you want a gun in your neighborhood if the police show up in 2 minutes? So instead of making it a religious divide over the difference between gun rights, they're looking at it from what they consider to be common sense. Same thing's happening right now with the pandemic. Pandemic's hitting hard in very liberal areas because the closer together you live, the more likely you are to be liberal. That's pure demographics, and it's based on what's best for you in any given situation. It's really hard to maintain a defined, hardcore, conservative perspective when you're living cheek to jowl with a lot of liberals. And the same's true is if you're a liberal living in rural areas where the coyotes are going to kill your sheep if you don't shoot them. And this is just the fact of life out here. The comparison of the two things, I just wanted to point out the demographic reason for the political divide on how we're opening the country. And now I can hand that back to you, still talking about opening and peaks.
I want to read something from Bloomberg. They've had a special newsletter that they're sending out on coronavirus, and I think it's probably an excellent way of what they call overcoming abstraction. Imagine that a plane crashed in early March, then another weeks later, soon several drop from the sky every day. People shun non-essential air travel, which limits the toll. But 2 months into the catastrophe, more than 1,000 still die daily, a jet crashing every few hours. How quickly would we rush back into the sky? Recorded deaths in the United States are now approaching 700,000. So imagine 9/11, 20 times over, repeating in a loop every day or two. About 7,000 Americans died in 19 years of war in Afghanistan and Iraq. The coronavirus killed more last week. 38,000 Americans die in car crashes each year, but that keeps few of us off the road. Driving carries a small but constant chance of death, a tolerable risk. As some states begin to open businesses, this is the calculation people must make, whether the risk is tolerable. We don't see images of the dead, who often die alone. No pictures of burning wreckage, falling tower, or scarred battlefields imprint the catastrophe in our mind. The fact that it's hidden doesn't diminish the tragedy, but it may affect how we think about it. That was from John Tozzi at Bloomberg.
Can you move your microphone a little closer to your mouth?
Okay. Is that better?
Yeah, that's better.
The reality is, and there's several estimates have come out, that if the economy was totally reopened right now, people can go anywhere they want to go, and the coronavirus spread is limited, and we don't get a second wave, which I think we probably will.
We will get one, yes.
Then, well, that was you need to run that through the compliance.
Well,
office.
I mean, I've run it by some
statement.
Yeah, we may be in a second wave. It's really hard to measure waves when they're constant and hitting the lapping at the top. If you look at the death rates, you see waves up and down. Just how do you want to measure the wave?
Until we get an effective vaccine and everybody is convinced they're not at risk when they go out of getting coronavirus, the most we could probably return to is about 90% of the economic activity that we had before. Let me put that differently. We're looking for a 10% drop in GDP even if we open up the economy.
Right.
Completely.
Yeah.
And that is a lot. Again, economists can only make estimates, but it's coming out pretty consistently across the board that we're seeing what's happened is Georgia, for example, is opening up. The other places are opening up. People are not rushing back into the bars and rushing back into the restaurant. Restaurants, for example, generally speaking, cannot make a profit with 20% of their tables full,
yeah,
or 25% of their tables full. As a result, a lot of them are not going to open up. This is going to be one of the things I think we all have to get our mind wrapped around. Is this could last for a year or it could last for 2 years, but it ain't going to be over in a couple of months.
Yeah, I've got some good news to throw in the middle of this and some hypotheticals to throw at the end of it. I have mentioned last week that I've been speaking to doctors that their specialty is infectious disease and to epidemiologists. Talked to a lot of people on the subject and a lot of economists, and I've studied it. Not the disease, but the impact of the economy. And Elder Baldy, hopefully you sneezed into your elbow. Did you do that? My 5-year-old daughter gets very upset if I use my hand, or she's not upset in an overly dramatic way, but she tells me to be the elephant, and she's very good at reminding me. So I better learn this. Okay, so back to the other reason for sneezing. Did you read the story about Oxford's vaccine?
Go ahead.
Okay. Oxford, the university, in their infectious disease area of research, and they've got a medical area that's just studying infectious disease. And they've been working on a separate type of coronavirus, the MERS, which is the Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, which is it's got the same coronavirus pieces and even some of the same spike proteins. So they were working with a new methodology for creating vaccines before coronavirus hit. And what they've done is they've taken a rhinovirus, a cold virus, and they've stripped it out and they've made it really, really bland. Nothing that the immune system would see as irritating at all. Basically, they have an envelope. And they were working on filling the envelope with spike proteins from MERS, which are very similar to the spike proteins. They're different, but they're very similar to the spike proteins on SARS-CoV-2. So this is the coronavirus, COVID-19. And what they were doing with this envelope, and what they for the other version, is they're filling it up with the spike protein and then injecting it into rhesus monkeys. The rhesus monkeys would, their immune system builds antibodies to the spike protein, which when they are consciously infected later, the immune system immediately attacks the virus and there it doesn't propagate. So they don't get sick. So this is was big announcement is that they're in phase two of human trials this week. And another announcement is that AstraZeneca has decided to pre-approval begin the production process for this Oxford-based vaccine. There was an announcement from the largest generic drug manufacturer on the planet, which is an Indian company, that they plan on having 300 million doses manufactured by the end of December. Now, this is a vaccine that's not through trials yet. It shows a lot of promise, but it's not through trials. Well, what are trials? What would get this vaccine out to us by the end of December, which is a big, big, big hoop to leap through? Because there's a lot of ethical concerns when doing human studies. The way you test a vaccine is you inject using double-blind, which means that the person doing the injection and the person receiving the injection either get a placebo or the actual vaccine, and they don't know which. Neither of them knows which. It's recorded, but then they're sent out into the population. And there may be hundreds of them or thousands of them, and you know, when you're talking about the flu, you mix them around enough, and over a year, you check and see how many of them got sick. And if you see a vast majority of the people that got sick were placebo people, then it's a good vaccine, and nobody's reporting strange growths or weird anything else. Okay, it's a good vaccine. They do a lot of other medical tests as well, but that's the very, very simple lay-term methodology of what they're doing. How do you do that when you've got social distancing going on? You inject a bunch of people with placebo and a bunch of people with the vaccination, and you tell them to go out and do what they would normally do, which is sit in your house and come into contact with no one. So how do you know if the vaccine works? In a human trial in that condition, it would take more than 2 years to figure out if the vaccine worked. Okay, so how do we get it out faster? Well, there's an unethical way that no scientist is going to sign off on, which is what we did in World War II. We actively injected the real virus to the people that had been vaccinated, both with placebo and without. And it killed people. And the scientists have said, we're not doing that anymore. You don't intentionally harm people to try to help other people. Within reason. You can do like an organ transplant, so long as it's not a 40% death rate for the person that donates the organ. So this is the concept, the ethical side. Okay, so now we're going to move into governmental action, and then I'm going to hand it back to you. This is where the good news comes out. It sounds like I've just stomped on any concept that we might get a vaccine. I'm going to give you an example of something else and then tie it together. 3M had a lot of N95 masks in China. Well, what were they doing in China? Well, that's where they were made. It's an American company, but they were making a whole bunch of their masks in China. They have plants here as well. When we first started saying we're going to have mask shortages, we said, bring us those masks. China said, nope, those are essential for Chinese health. We've done the same thing on lots of different products. So is India. So it's a very normal thing in a pandemic to say, if the stuff is here, you can't bring it, you can't take it out of the country because we need it. China's done it, we've done it. So we can point the finger at them and they can point the finger at us, but it's not really a blame thing. This is a very natural occurrence in government. You know you can't take these masks out, we might need them. Doesn't matter if you're speaking in Mandarin or English. Okay, so said all that. If India proceeds with what is already happening under the numbers, the vast majority of the population of India has no access to health care at all. They have no clear methodology for tracking who's sick. If there's an Indian company that's manufacturing 100 million doses of this thing, but it's not been fully tested on the population, I can very easily see Prime Minister Modi saying, we're going to inject all of these and keep making more because the threat of bad side effects is nowhere near as bad as the threat of the actual virus, which could be an exception for the FDA to say, all right, we approve this drug. Look, there's 100 million people in India that didn't get sick because they were injected. All right, we're going to use it. So there is the weird and convoluted way that we may actually see a vaccine by the end of the year. It would have to work. It all has to work. But there is a path there that follows rationality.
They're actually going to be testing. They're going to be using it in a double-blind study on 6,000 people by the end of next month, the Jenner Institute of Oxford.
That's right.
The issue is, where do we roll if it works? And we won't know for several months if it works.
And that's the point. We won't know unless somebody does something really drastic, like inoculate a whole bunch of people as test subjects that are more than the normal test subject base.
Now, by the way, it worked on...
Rhesus monkeys.
It worked on rhesus monkeys. It worked very well. 28 days after six of them were heavily exposed to the virus, and the monkeys get it just as quickly and just as readily as we do. They gave it to six monkeys, and the monkeys did not get sick after being heavily exposed to the virus. And so there's a lot of hope here. The problem is spinning it up. In the United States, we'd have to make 300 million
And that's what
doses.
The Trump administration is calling for. They're saying we need 300 million doses by the end of the year.
But then we have to get them to people.
Right.
And we have to get people to accept them.
Yep.
And we have to have enough hypodermic needles, and we have to have enough storage facility, and we have to have the capacity to make it. If this thing works in humans, we could have a fix for it. But the problem is, and this is where we'll have to see, is how well it works.
Right.
A lot of things
that's
we still don't know about this virus. We don't know why people, after they have it, and after they have been certified as not having it anymore, and they test and they clear test a significant number of the people, are experiencing a reoccurrence of some of the symptoms. Now, it's not killed anybody. The second wave in a human being hasn't killed anybody yet. But it apparently is damaging the lungs and damaging things to the point where people are experiencing the symptoms again after they thought they were well. And they're testing positive for the virus again. Now, the second test that's positive brings up another problem, and that is the tests that we have aren't 100% accurate, and they can give false positives and false negatives. We're still stumbling around in the dark.
Yeah, and ours are better than Russia's. Russia's have a false negative 20% of the time.
Which brings us up to some very big geopolitical stuff, but we haven't done commercials, and we only have about 10 minutes.
Yeah, we got to run some commercials. We do have another hour after this as well. Hopefully people are enjoying this as much as we are. We're going to play some commercials, and we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. Normally we would give phone numbers, but the only line into the studio is in use at the moment. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, and I'm going to bring Elder Baldy's mic up.
My mic feels like it just rose.
All right, you can now be heard. It's amazing.
Good.
Welcome back. We're still talking economic impact of COVID-19, as if we can fit that into a two-hour program.
There's a lot of things that are going to fall out of this at the back end that we're not even imagining, but the things we can imagine are going to be pretty amazing. You look at the collapse in the use of oil, the collapse in the price of oil, and you look at just that one element alone, which was dramatically exacerbated by the price war between Russia and Saudi Arabia right at the beginning of this thing, which, for whatever it's worth, I think of the geopolitical stupidity ratio of 1 to 10, that was about a 9.5.
I would say it fell off the chart.
Well, I don't know. Dropping nuclear weapons on somebody randomly, that would be...
Yeah, that would be bad, too.
You know, the fact that countries have nuclear weapons, the fact is that they haven't used them because they would get them used back on them rather quickly, they think. But the issue is that the Russian government is showing signs of great instability at this point. They're running out of currency, they're running out of foreign exchange currency that they need to buy things. They are shut down more severely than we are, and they don't have a system to deal with it, and they're running on the edge before, which is kind of like what we're seeing in the United States. A lot of companies, J. Crew, Macy's, a lot of companies that are kind of the companies that we, Neiman Marcus,
JCPenney.
JCPenney has been going down for a long time. Sears has been going down for a long time, but I didn't know that Neiman Marcus was on the edge of collapse. Neiman Marcus was a symbol to me through most of my lifetime as being a very healthy, ongoing place for luxury shopping. And these companies are going to disappear. The name may be around. It's like Stetson's around, but it hasn't been an actual company in many, many years. But we're going to see some tremendous fallout on the backside of this thing. And what comes out of the backside of this viral pandemic that's going to last at least a year is going to be an economy that may not be very recognizable. A lot of positives are going to come out of it, and a lot of negatives. See, robotic laboratories and robotic institutes are gearing up and going as fast as they can go. The question is whether the technology is good enough to meet the need at this point. But we're moving very, very fast, and we're going to be propelled to move very fast.
Yeah, and this is how we get the technology good enough fast, is by you have a big demand where people are willing to pay for it. And that's happening right now.
And we've had an economy that's been focused on efficiency, probably to excess, which doesn't, because the efficiency is good, we think. But the more efficient something gets, the less resilient it is. And that's something that's very poorly understood unless you've studied economics.
Well, or Star Trek. If you're a Star Trek fan, Klingons have two hearts, but it makes their life expectancy shorter because they're more resilient and less efficient. There.
Oh.
There
well,
you go.
I think in some cases, more resiliency in our case would amount to longer life expectancy. Companies that have been more resilient that haven't leverage themselves up tremendously, and the individuals who haven't leveraged themselves up, they haven't borrowed a lot of money to do their investing and their production of goods and services, are far more resilient than the ones who haven't. For example, a lot of people are in a world of hurt because they bought houses, sometimes a lot of houses, to use as Airbnbs.
Yeah.
Because the rental return on using an Airbnb is much higher than simply renting the house out. As a matter of fact, in many cases, there are houses that wouldn't be very attractive for a standard rental property, because of the quality of people that rent that tend to be in the lower socioeconomic group.
Right.
But they can make a good, you know, so they have a mortgage that people don't think about the fact that when they get a mortgage or they purchase a mortgage that somebody already has, a transferable mortgage, to buy a house to rent it out, they make an assumption, and the assumption is that the rental income will cover
the mortgage
payment and then pay them back a little bit.
Yeah.
And what we're seeing across the country right now is what that's called leveraging.
Yeah.
Basically, they don't think of it as leveraging because the house is collateral, and the collateral is secured, so it's no big thing. Well, that's not true.
We generally tell people, educationally, if you're going to go into real estate, then you need to have a cash reserve by going into real estate for rental market, Airbnb or not. You need to have a cash reserve that's somewhere around 10% of the value of the house, so you don't get over leveraged and it's just used for that house's rental items. And we're about out of time this hour, so I'm going to pull the microphone down so we don't blare the commercials out. The phone lines are a little finicky.
If you'd like to contact us off the air, we actually do have phones that you can call in there locally at 947-1111 or toll-free 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. There's recordings of our radio program going back quite a number of years. There's newsletters. You can read our philosophy. You can contact us through the contact form or email us directly at jeff at tpwc.com or jake at tpwc.com.